You want me to discriminate against you?
Don't change your habits.
Is Fred coming? Need his vote to move it.
Yes. Let's go ahead, gentlemen, ladies.
We're taking up 287.
What's 287?
An act prohibiting sex discrimination in education, state, nation, or...
No, what we're gonna do is have an act legalizing sex.
How about legalizing fornication?
Oh.
Adultery.
Listen, I'm coming home.
What?
This is the big one. Fornicating, adultery. He's talented. We can't have that stuff.
I didn't say bestiality, I said...
That's the best speech you've given all year.
That's been our law since Moses. We can't change it now. That was written in rock.
I liked that speech.
Oh, that adultery speech was written right up on Mount Sinai, inspired by God. We're gonna come down here and just meet you a little committee and change it, legalize it.
Well, who's changing it in the committee?
I was kidding.
Lisa said she'd ask me out for days.
Yeah, but he said he doesn't pay very much, so...
I'm a lot of things, but I'm not
You have
dumb.
Principles too, I guess.
No, I'm just not dumb.
That's the best way to go. I was thinking.
I have to separate. Page 62, let's do arson, criminal mischief, and related offenses.
Criminal mischief.
We haven't done criminal mischief. That's a reserve.
That's kind of a cheap title.
We're
into arson and, risking a catastrophe is one of the most unique offenses that only appears in
What is it? Not offenses.
Offenses. Okay, let's start out. Arson in the first degree.
Okay. This is on page 62. The statute's on page 62. The existing law is on page 121. In existing law, currently we recognize 4 degrees of arson. In the code, only 2 degrees are recognized. So we haven't created a wealth of degrees, at least there. And existing law primarily distinguishes between whether the structure you are burning is a dwelling as opposed to a building. And you can get some odd results, at least if you read this under that distinction, because under existing law, burning a building that is adjacent to the dwelling, such as an outhouse, say, is considered burning the dwelling itself. So under existing law, burning a restaurant, a crowded restaurant, which is not a dwelling, is treated less severely than, say, burning an outhouse. What we've done is we've changed that. We've decided that the most serious form of arson involves protected property, and we define that term, and that's on in arson in the first degree, it's line 15. A person commits a crime of arson in the first degree by starting a fire or causing an explosion. He intentionally damages protected property of another. And protected property is defined on page 64, line 6, as a structure, place, or thing customarily occupied by people, including but not limited to buildings in which persons congregate for civic, political, educational, religious, or recreational purposes, and all lands on which grass, brush, timber, and other natural vegetative material grows. And what we've attempted to do there is to give protection to forest land in Alaska, to say that the burning of forest land is protected property, and that's first degree arson. Now, under existing law, you can commit arson even though you burn your own property. In the revised code, you cannot. It is not arson to burn your own property, with one very important exception. The focus of the arson article is to prevent damage to protected property and also prevent endangering a person as a result of the arsonist act. So in line on section 2 here, on line 16 on page 62, we recognize that first degree arson occurs if you damage any property, regardless of whether it's yours or another person's, and the act of damaging the property recklessly places a person in danger of physical injury or protected property of another in danger of damage. So if a person in some remote area decides to burn down his house, it is not going to be arson unless it damages protected property to someone else or it damages a person. Now, you have a situation, of course, of what happens if a person burns down his own house in Anchorage. Well, it, based on my interpretation of the statute, I think that when a person burns down his own house in Anchorage, the likelihood, of course, of having the police, the firemen come, and I think you've committed first-degree arson there because you're recklessly placing a person with a physical injury and putting out the fire. Now, existing law also has a separate offense called burning to defraud an insurer, and it's to cover the person that takes out insurance and burns his own house down to collect the money. We didn't feel it was necessary to have a statute like that, as that would probably be covered under that same section, subsection 2. That is, you're burning your own property and it puts a person in danger of physical injury or protected property of another in danger of damage. But you could, again, have a situation where the person burns his cabin down in a remote area and is not damaging anyone or any protected property. Under those circumstances, that would amount to theft by deception. You don't need to have a separate offense of burning your own property. So we've eliminated that offense, but it is included in the code.
Right. What happens? My wife and I own our house together and I out in the woods and I set it on fire and burn it down because I'm mad at it.
Yeah.
If I committed a crime against her, half the house?
Yeah. On page 64, line 11, we require that you burn property of another, and we specifically recognize that property of another includes property belonging wholly in part to your spouse. So, if your spouse has an interest in the property, that's considered arson. And that's existing law, that concept.
Would that be charged with arson, or does she have to bring a complaint in that case? You know?
I'm not sure the mechanics of it.
Probably, they wouldn't prosecute if she didn't complain.
I assume that would be correct. Yeah. I'm really not certain how that works in terms of the necessity to have a complaint in there. But it recognizes that it is not a defense that the property belonged to your spouse.
Can I ask a question? On line 17, when you recklessly place another person in danger of physical injury,
what page would be on?
62. Do you have to use the word recklessly there? In other words, even if you place somebody in danger accidentally, it doesn't count as arson?
Well, that's correct. You would have to be aware. You would have to be aware of the risk that it was placing someone in danger. It couldn't be just as a result of a negligent act. I don't think it could ever be. The issue, of course, is...
Well, it we has have a current statute on that we passed in 75 legislature. What does it say?
You're talking about the negligent use of combustible material statutes?
Yes.
Yeah. That's on page 122. A person who negligently or recklessly causes a fire which results in physical harm to another person or in damage to the property of another is guilty of a misdemeanor. And I think that negligently there means criminal negligence. I don't think it could be a result of ordinary negligence. I think the Supreme Court would interpret it that way. We recognize that with criminal negligence you can cause you've committed a crime, and also if you've acted with criminal negligence by means of a fire, you've committed an assault, because a fire would be considered a dangerous instrument under the assault article. So if you act with criminal negligence, you have committed an assault. It's not arson. Arson is a term that is used, I think you should use it fairly limited, in a limited sense, because I think it connotes some very bad activity. And to say that a person's negligent act or criminal negligence acts is sufficient, I don't think the term is ever used to do that. So we cover that conduct, criminal negligence. Ordinary negligence, no. The person is just negligent, and that's going to give rise to a civil action. He has that standard of criminal negligence.
Mr. Chair, the reason that the bill arose, and I seem to remember that it might have been amended in some bad way, and maybe that's how it got negligently or recklessly amended. It was introduced to address situations like the fire of the car in the middle of a hotel in Fairbanks, where five died. It was found that the fire was caused by a fellow who fell asleep smoking a cigar after he had several times been warned about it, that he had caused minor kind of incidents like that before. But he drank too much, and you know, when he drank, he'd smoke and he'd fall asleep, and he set the whole place building on fire, and if it hadn't been for our fire department, they would have knocked down all of the downtown Second Avenue, at least if I remember the mood of the first session of the ninth, you talked about your policy position with regard to following what recent legislatures have done. As far as I'm concerned, even if it is so-called simple negligence, it ought at least to be a misdemeanor.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in terms of structuring that, I think that
you have a more serious thing to be a felon.
Yeah. But we have I had to go over this, what was done last year. What we did is we took that criminal negligent, the combustible use of materials statute, and it said reckless negligence in terms of the culpable mental state. We split that up into two crimes. One was called reckless burning, and one was called criminally negligent homicide. Criminally negligent burning. If you acted recklessly, it would be an A misdemeanor. If you were just criminal negligence, it would be a B misdemeanor. Now, you had also the element of causing injury to a person, the actual causing of injury to a person. I don't see any need to continue that in the reckless burning statute or the criminally negligent burning statute if you cover it adequately under the assault statute. And it is covered under the assault statute. With criminal negligence, you cause physical injury with criminal negligence by means of a dangerous instrument, and that's covered under the assault section.
It sure seems awfully contrived. After we pass it, it may be there, right, in the assault statute, it may well be, but I find it hard to believe that somebody, you know, is going to be. I can see a big uproar coming when somebody's charged with assault because of negligence.
Fred, I should clear something up. As it was in the preliminary report, they did cover causing physical injury. I recommended that they change it, and they're going to consider it at the next meeting. I didn't realize the history of that statute. It's your feeling that you would like to have a specific provision in here to cover the causing physical injury within reckless burning.
To me, the most important part of that, I think, consider having even simple negligence, which results in actual injury to other people because of negligent use of combustible materials. Have that as a misdemeanor. Even just simple negligence and not the so-called gross negligence that is normally considered to be the level of what would be required for crime.
Yeah, I think that there are real constitutional problems with that.
Anyway, it's a concern, and it was a rather overwhelming concern 2 years ago. I remember, I think it was Tim Wallace's bill. And boy, that guy, after he left there, he went over to the Steele Hotel, when it was still away, 4 days later, and he got, and they went ahead and they had all kinds of firemen in there, they arrested him, he was, you know, his whole room was smoldering over in the Steele Hotel 4 days after the North Hotel burned.
Very often when that happens, people that are drunk, you know, they're just too insensible to know what they're doing. It's just insensible.
Yeah, we're gonna. I understand your point about concluding the physical injury there. I myself have some real problems again about making a negligence standard there. You might try to redraft it so you make it. In other words, not use the term negligence, but make it affect strict liability. But I think it's very difficult.
Well, the thing about injury to another address is particularly trying to see what we can for what would make this negligence possible.
So we have the 2 degrees of arson, and again, arson in the first degree is protected property or endangering someone or endangering the protected property. Arson is a second degree and is damaging any building other than protected property. Then again, what I've just touched on, we have two other crimes. One is called reckless burning, the other one is called criminal negligent burning. And the reckless burning statute covers a reckless act, the criminally negligent burning statute covers a criminally negligent act. What we did is, of course, is we split your statute up into two parts.
Barry, can you give me an example of a building that's not subject to crime?
Yeah. Someone's storage shed standing maybe in a substantial distance. Well, yeah, that's correct. Someone's storage shed. Now, the thing is, you damage it. If you set fire to it, if it's in close proximity to the house, mm-hmm. you're going to be committing first degree arson because you're endangering the house. But protected property would cover that storage shed. I'm sorry, someone's property that was not protected property would be a storage shed. Protected property is broad enough to cover like a restaurant situation.
I'm going to give this chair to Elias.
How about a warehouse? It's not. Does occupied mean that people customarily work there? It says customarily occupied by people. Does that mean where people live or where they work and live? Or?
Yeah, on page 72, we quoted from the Oregon Code that a standard should be used in determining when something was customarily occupied. And basically, it's a two-prong standard, and either one fits in terms of determining whether it's customarily occupied. The first one is by reason or circumstance of time and place when the fire or explosion occurs, people are normally in the building, structure, or thing, or circumstances are such as to make the fact of occupancy by persons a reasonable possibility. So I think you've got a warehouse in the evening, and someone is, you know, there's a reasonable possibility there's going to be a guard there, so I think it would be covered. Now, what we did in existing law covers is arson damaging personal property of another person. In other words, setting fire to a bicycle, for example. We don't cover that as arson. We're going to cover that as criminal mischief. Arson has been always associated with burning a structure or a building. Now, we are going to cover the burning of personal property. It just is not going to be covered as arson.
Not a vehicle either.
Unless we would cover a vehicle, for example, like a camper, that was that would be considered a building if it was adapted for use by people. But if it were just a vehicle, a car sitting in front of someone's house, that would not be arson if you burned it. But if it was sitting in front of someone's house, I think you could make a very strong argument that that's endangering his house, and that would be arson in the first degree. But just burning the house would not be, I'm sorry, just burning the vehicle is not arson. It's still a crime. It's not arson.
How would you handle this case where, I mean, we have so many of them up here where people can't make dependence on the car. They said they injure the car, they burn them up.
Yeah.
And that's not an arson.
Well, that's theft by deception. It's, and it's going to be criminal tampering or criminal mischief.
One felony or mischief?
Theft by deception, yeah, that one would be the felony. And criminal mischief, we haven't done criminal mischief, and I'm not sure whether there's going to be a felony-type criminal mischief. There may very well be. But it's been in the codes, it's been the approach is to look just at property in terms of buildings and dwellings within the concept of arson, to treat personal property within a criminal mischief statute. And again, it's emphasizing the danger to people as opposed to the danger to property. I think we are concerned about the danger to property if it endangers people. The person is going to be in the car at the time it's being burned is going to be arson because you're endangering the person, and that would be arson in the first degree.
That's interesting. Well, suppose somebody has a Winnebago that he frequently lives in. He doesn't have to be in it at the time. And somebody burns it, and that ends up only being mischief.
No, that's arson. That would be arson, because that would be a building. That would be considered a building. The Winnebago would be considered a building.
Okay.
So, if in fact it was under circumstances that someone could be there, for example, it was in a campground, you set far the Winnebago, that's going to be protected property.
I just can't get here by 7. It costs me $25 if I keep my wife in town and take her out to eat. By the time I drive out the valley, get her home and get back at 7:30, it's that simple.
Well, we'll have to have a key schedule.
And on $35 a day, I can't afford $25 for dinner to eat.
Well, I'm going to give you a solution.
Yeah.
It's a democratic solution.
What's that?
Stay in town and don't eat.
Play basketball.
I developed this habit. I cut out lunch. By 5 o'clock in the evening, my stomach thinks my throat's cut.
Does the Judiciary Committee keep spiking relief funds so that you can get the...
Just get the pay bill out, man.
Well, since Terry and I have been told to a statewide public radio audience that we are the favorite customers of the local gourmet restaurant, maybe we ought to have the evening committee meetings catered by the den.
Or just let's get over it.
The last time I went there, I had
oh, yeah.
The last time I went there, I had some dry out.
So I'm going to be
terrible.
I hope you didn't order
orders,
right?
I said, I'll never go back.
Don't ever order a steak.
Sorry to be late.
We ordered T-bone at Bottle of Matthews, and we'll probably intentionally burn it.
I've only been there once this year, and I was there a couple times.
The page 63 Philly Controller reported dangerous fire. That's a statute that's based substantially on a provision appearing in Title 41, Public Resources. And what this covers is a person who is under a duty to give to put out fires or to give notice of alarm, or the person that starts a fire on his land. And what it does is makes a misdemeanor offense for a person who fails to put out the fire or give fire alarm when the fire is endangering life or a substantial amount of property. And now under existing law, the statute covers the situation where you, where it's forest land, and this covers all land. Existing law only covers the situation where actual property is damaged. We recognize that when you're endangering life or, substantial amount of property, that is an offense just for the sake of failing to try to put it out or to give fire alarm, regardless of whether there's actual damage. And this statute now is in, like I said, in Title 41, and in the arson...
Title 41 on?
Public resources. And the... You know, the idea of the code being very difficult to use is really manifested in arson, I think, because you have a separate article covering, it's called arson and related offenses now, and it covers the 4 degrees of arson that we have under existing law. Now, the statute on combustible use of negligent use of combustible materials is contained in the offenses against the person chapter, and that's in a totally different section than the arson article. And in addition, we have a number of statutes covering arson-type offenses in Title 41. So,
okay. Any questions on that section?
I'm interested in the catastrophe.
Yeah, that's okay. This is the exotic section. I think Terry was more involved. Certainly, was more involved in this one than I was. I can only report what the statute. It's not page 63. There are two crimes that the commission created that I don't know if they necessarily exist in existing law. Elements of them do. And it recognizes that in certain situations, the causing of damage to property or damage to structures or causing serious physical injury to people should be an 8 felony. When it's particularly bad type of causing injury. For example, under the arson statute, if you burn a warehouse and it's not protected property and it's not arson in the first degree, regardless of how much damage you cause, it's only going to be a deep felony. What this statute does is say that when you cause damage, property loss in excess of $500,000, it's going to be a felony. In addition, if you cause serious physical injury to 10 or more people, it's going to be an A felony, or you cause substantial damage to 10 or more separate dwellings or structures. Now, this doesn't cover causing that type of injury by any means. What it's aimed at is dangerous and difficult to confine forces or substances. And we gave examples of that. Explosion, fire, flood, avalanche, collapse of a building, release of poison, radioactive material, or bacteria. And you actually cause a catastrophe, and causing the catastrophe is defined on page 21 there. I'm sorry, page 63, line 21. If you actually cause a catastrophe, it's an A felony. If you just risk a catastrophe, in other words, you're handling radioactive material or something in a particularly reckless way, and nothing happens, thank goodness, but there was a damn good chance of someone being injured, not only someone, but 10 people, it's going to be a B felony. Now,
you mean if you go out to a big warehouse and blow it up and there's nobody in there, and you puss it off dynamite and maybe you find out later there was only 9 people in there, that you're only guilty of class B felony?
You were 9 people in there?
Well, you said less than. Well, where did you come up with the figure 10? 1 is 9 is 20. That seems like such a serious crime. You can kill a lot of people and blow up a big building and it seems
to be a big.
It would be
something else. If you blew up the building, you killed someone, that would be murder. That would be felony murder.
All right.
This is directed at kind of unleashing, blowing up dams and things, you know,
rioting against police and things.
Doing weird things.
Well, I don't know if it covers riot here. But,
causing jets to crash. You know, we have this whole rash of people thinking up these incredible things.
Derailing trains.
Yeah, blowing up pipelines or, bombs in airports where people are just doing very potentially dangerous things. I remember one of the things that happened right when we were discussing this was somebody, when they had a big thing where they were going to blow up the power lines from the Grand Coulee Dam to Portland Remember there were some crazy people running around. And this is kind of directed at crazies who unleash, you know, large forces, whether natural or otherwise, that aren't specifically directed. The best example is dropping the boulder off the top of the court building into a crowd of people. I mean, it's not directed at any one specific person, but it's obviously a very dangerous thing to be doing. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mention by Mr. Brown about derailing a train should be seriously considered under this heading, because that it might be a string of boxcars or something on a downgrade that you release that could get up at momentous speed, tear loose, crashing a bunch of buildings, etc.
I think that would be that is covered under our assault statute, because you would be acting recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life.
Essentially, there's no difference between that and causing the collapse of a building.
I agree. I'm not disagreeing with that. I think that in some respects the statute is unnecessary. I think in others it is very necessary. I think it gets at the situation where you cause property law. I mean, the one I'm really concerned about here is the property loss one here. Because if you cause property loss in excess of $500,000, it's going to be an A felony. It's aggravating that type of conduct. Now, as to the assault sections, I'm not too sure this statute is even necessary, because we've covered it already.
I get what you mean. Okay.
Lisa?
With causing a catastrophe, you would cover the... You know that bill that you're the prime sponsor on, Terry, damages to pipelines and things? If somebody shot a hole in a pipeline and let $500,000 worth of oil out of the pipeline, would that cover it or not?
The only way I can see it is if you argue that, you see, you have to cause catastrophe by certain means, and one of the means is an explosion. I think if you set off a bomb there and you do it, it's going to be covered. If you shoot it, shoot a gun through it, shoot a bullet through it, I'm not sure whether that's an explosion.
Yeah.
So, it's a pretty specific statute, and again, it's aimed at, as I understand it, it's based on, Terry just asked me who has it, New Jersey for one in their proposed code, Missouri in their proposed code. It's based on a model penal code provision. And it's European countries have this thing of called common danger, a concept of endangering a good number of people, and they create that, they make that as a separate crime. American jurisdictions have never had that type of offense, and this is an attempt to do it. But again, it's looking at something that people think of as a common danger. I think if you look at those terms, explosion, fire, flood, avalanche, collapse of a building, release of a poison, radioactive material, it almost seems like it's a basis for a whole bunch of disaster movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty exotic way.
Yeah.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if, as we move more into this gas and oil and pipeline era, if we really don't need to examine that area of potential for felony.
Yeah, we got a bill in there. We're going to get it next week. It's called Energy Fleet. So exactly that. Okay. Lisa, were you finished?
Well, I'm still not sure whether by listing explosion, fire, and so on and so forth, that you are, of course, limiting it to certain things. And
you've got that phrase, dangerous and difficult.
Well, that
forces or substances.
But it says, or release of poison, radioactive material, and so on, or other dangerous and difficult to confine force or substance. It doesn't say explosion, fire, flood, avalanche, collapse of a building, or other catastrophic event or something like that, so that you are limited in that section to explosion, fire, flood, avalanche, collapse of a building. And I'm not sure that that's wise. Because there's always a new way to cause a catastrophe, which we have a clear idea.
Chairman, returning to the words release of poison, et cetera, you have a situation involving.
I drive tankers away if I came up with something like that. What I'm saying is Lisa's right. And then everything else like that phrase relates only to the stuff after release of poison. And then you have this agglutinative phrase prior to that. Agglutinative phrase prior to that. Now, I don't know if this is Herbert Wexler's language, but shame on him if he did it. Because
he was the father of the model penal code.
Yeah.
Or the mother of the model penal code.
At any rate, explosion, fire, flood, avalanche, collapse of a building, it sounds like we're listing a stick, knife, dirk, or other thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's that style of drafting again.
Yeah, my personal side on that is I don't like the statute. I haven't tried, you know.
Truth will out.
I didn't have, again, it's there, and I didn't participate in the drafting of it. I probably would do it a little differently. We're going to have a meeting again. I could bring it to their attention.
I think it's a good idea, and I think as far as they draft.
Yeah. The idea, though, that we want to get at, though, is to cover conduct that would ordinarily not be a serious offense because the offense does not distinguish between how much damage you cause, and to say that when you cause a certain amount of damage or you injure a certain amount of people, it's a more serious offense. And it's a useful concept. Again, I have problems with the statute because I would have hoped that we could have covered the the damage to the pipeline within this statute. But when I read it, when the problem came up a few weeks ago, I immediately thought of this statute, then I looked at it and I said, well, we don't cover, shooting in the pipeline. So, we'll work on this.
Further questions?
I like that idea, too.
Yeah, I said,
yeah.
We ought to have one of them, but that ain't it.
Somebody might sabotage an airplane sometime, not by an explosion, but by fixing some instrument or something so it misreads.
We have a pretty serious offense on tampering.
Yeah, well, if you sabotage the airplane, again, I don't think there's a need here to cover the conduct of injuring a person. Because if you kill them or you assault them, It's going to be first, it's going to be either murder or it's going to be first degree assault, which is either going to be an A felony or 0 to 99 years for the homicide provisions.
We have something that homicide provisions covered tampering an aircraft, even if people aren't on it. It's covered somewhere. Because we got it, there is an existing statute on tampering of aircraft. I know we covered this somewhere.
You and I would get to use it anyway, but federal, so take over.
It might be in the criminal, again, we've held up on the criminal mischief stuff, so.
Is that that clear? Okay, we need to cover anything else under ours.
I just thought I'd break out the Latin at least once.
I thought it was great.
And it was actually quite correct. Only time I ever have a chance to use both those phrases with regard to same bill.
Okay, let's turn to page 77.
Yeah, that's forgery.
Now the page is...
Page 77. All I have to say is, reviewing forgery, there's very spotty coverage, and I could understand why that Fairbanks case came up. The Fairbanks case is the case where a man sold a false residence card to someone, and he told them that, hey, buddy, this is a false card, and they weren't able to get him because it requires that you fool the person that you're selling it to. And, you know, I was today in the library reviewing this material. I was looking at the statutes, and boy, there are loopholes throughout.
Do you remember the bill we passed on? It's in the Senate now?
No. No.
We passed a specific bill. I think it's House Bill 138.
Yeah. Well, with the code, you wouldn't need a specific bill because we would cover it under a general definition.
Did Judge Blair agree with you?
I haven't spoken to him. Okay. And under existing law, there are three main distinctions in forgery. And, existing law distinguishes between what can be forged, by what means forgery can be accomplished, and with what culpable mental state the person might act. And there are 16 statutes now in existing law covering forgery, approximately 16. We cover it in one. And it's just interesting to go over some of the statutes in terms of the specificity of some of the provisions. Like one provision covers forging an artificial earmark, button, or brand upon a horse, mare, gelding, mule, jenny, swine, goat, or steer. Another provision covers forging a receipt for pork, beef, or wool delivered to a warehouse. And
this is in current statutes?
Yeah, current statutes. Yeah.
Well, people are actually.
It's a demonstration of
some
why
people
need a new criminal.
I just hope that we have a whole bunch of those things to throw out on the floor of the house next year, and then somebody says, why do we need this thing?
Yeah.
Why don't you put together a little packet?
Oh, yeah, I'll be able to do that.
Yeah, some of the more outrageous things you can come up with, like that.
Well, it's a Ripley's Believe It or Not. You know, it's just, you know, it's you hate to get to that level to say that this is why we need to do criminal code.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with getting to that level.
Anything for a vote.
But we'll make up something like that. Okay, the other way, okay, so we have these specific statutes covering what can be forged. In addition, we have specific ways that forgery can be accomplished, and it lists stuff like making, altering, forging, counterfeiting, printing, photographing, altering, passing. Now, that's like all the terms that are used in those 16 statutes, but not all those statutes use those same terms. For example, one statute won't cover photographing. So there's the potential there again for loopholes. The final way existing law distinguishes is between what culpable mental state the person must act with in committing the forgery. And some statutes require that the person act willfully or knowingly. Another statute requires that he act willfully and knowingly. In addition to acting willfully or knowingly, or willfully and knowingly, some require that he act with an intent to deceive, others require that he act with intent to defraud or deceive. And there's no, you know, explanation for these differences. Now, the solution in the code, again, is to have one statute, and that's on page 77, and it begins on line 12, and it's forgery. And what this covers is the false making, completing, or altering of a written instrument, now, with an intent to defraud. Now, the key terms, there are a lot of key terms in that statute, and they're all defined. In order to commit forgery, you must act with an intent to defraud. And that is defined on page 81 of the draft, on line 13, and an intent to defraud means an intent to use deception or to injure someone's interest which has value. Now, deception is defined, is used in the theft section when we're talking about theft by deception, so that definition applies here. The second way for intent to defraud works is knowledge that the defendant is facilitating a fraud or injury to be perpetrated or inflicted by someone else, and that covers the false residency statutes that you were just mentioning. Now, the problem here of this bill is that it looks at the specific problem. It's looking at residency cards. Now, our statute doesn't look at a specific problem. It just covers all written instruments. So, under if this bill passes, you know, in that interim period, it'll be against the law to sell someone a residency card telling them that it's false, but it won't be against the law to sell them other means, like perhaps like a false driver's license.
Current law says that a person who knowingly passes a forged instrument can be charged with forgery.
The uttering of it.
Yeah.
We cover that.
That is not changed here, is
no,
it?
No, that's the other way. Returning to 77, forgery is committed two ways. And again, you have to act with that intent to defraud, which we just discussed. And then on line 14, it's committed if you falsely make, complete, or alter a written instrument. Now, falsely make, complete, and alter are defined again. And falsely making covers a situation where you draw a check and you completed every element. Falsely completing a written instrument covers a situation where the maker may have filled in everything except his name and you sign it. Falsely altering covers a situation where he gave you a check, he put $100, and you added a zero to it. So those are the three ways that forgery can be accomplished. And those terms, falsely making, falsely altering, and falsely completing, appear in every revised code. And it's inclusive and covers every way that forgery can be committed.
What about the
uttering? Okay, now uttering is now the next way that forgery can be committed, and that's line 16. And that is uttering a written instrument which you know to be forged. And uttering is defined, and uttering means basically giving the instrument to another person, tendering it, passing it. If you know it to be forged, you've committed forgery.
Not to get ahead of it, but back in 520, criminal possession of a forged device, I was curious about a person commits a crime of criminal possession of a forged device if he makes, and so on and so forth, equipment, or articles specifically designed for use in counterfeiting. Most of these forgery guys and counterfeit guys, you know, they get these check protectors. That's generally under the old law, they catch them with check protectors and whatever things from a typewriter to check protectors. But, what kind of device were you talking about there?
The statute got another section. The statute has another section, and that's in section 2. But that kind of thing, I guess we're talking about in section 1 is a plague for counterfeiting false residency cards. It has no other purpose but for counterfeiting false residency cards. Mm-hmm. Made up a plague. But in section 2 we cover...
You said equipment, not the plague. But you also say equipment and the equipment used for that plague and everything. The guy's in possession of a lot of that stuff. Wouldn't he be in trouble?
Yeah, well, if he... Like the equipment, you're talking about now the ink, for example?
I'm talking about a check protector. I'm talking about a printing press.
Okay, the printing
about
press.
About the thing that you can forge a lot of things.
Okay, is the printing press specifically designed for forgery?
No, it doesn't say that here.
You're right. Any device that you have that could be used for forgery would be criminal possession. Well, designed for use.
Specifically designed for use in counterfeiting. Or otherwise, so what instrument is specifically designed for counterfeiting?
Well, I think it would cover, now maybe I've answered this, I haven't given you the answer, that it would cover like the plate. Now when you're saying about the instrument, you're talking about the press, for example?
Now you covered that in here. I could understand maybe what a plate counterfeit or something.
But you said the printing press isn't covered.
But that's covered by subsection 2 on the next page. with intent to use or to aid or permit another to use a device for purposes of forgery, he makes or possesses any device, apparatus, equipment, or article capable of or adaptable to such use.
That's your check protector right there.
I don't know what a check protector is, so I'm going to have disadvantage.
The check protector is a device that that you use on business checks that perforates the check in a certain patterned way that is unique to it or a company. And the checks probably often have a legend on them that they are not valid unless they've been issued by a check protector.
Oh, you mean the thing that you hit?
Yeah.
And some have plates on them with embossed signatures.
Yeah.
Well,
take a look. Plates.
And very often it requires the signature from the check protector and another signature.
Well, it's going to be covered. If it's not covered under one, it's going to be covered under two.
Yeah, it's covered under two, I think.
The problem, of course, is the situation where the guy's a printing press. You just can't say you can't say that it's illegal to possess a printing press. You have to put an additional intent element. But if it's a device that the only purpose can be is for forging, then it's covered regardless of the intent. So
okay, I was wondering what the instrument was designed for. That hope that we're on the market. For illegal use. They have a specific purpose.
Yeah, the reason I think they use the terms equipment or article is just in case something is specifically designed. So forgery is covered in one statute and covers the person that actually makes the instrument or completes it or alters it. In addition, it covers the person that passes the instrument, the person that utters the instrument. The next statute is criminal possession of a forged instrument, and that's on line 18 on page 77. Now, in existing law, there's very spotty coverage for this. The only possession statutes we have under existing law is possession of counterfeit coins and possession of evidences of debt. And the commission decided that if you possess a forged instrument, knowing it to be forged and with intent to utter it, with intent to pass it, it should be a offense. And it shouldn't be just limited to those particular things in existing law. So it's one broad statute. The forgery device, you might be interested, it's only against the law to possess a forgery device if it's capable of forging coins or evidences of debt. In other words, if you have a forgery device that's capable of forging counterfeit residence cards, it's not against existing law. So we have one statute covering criminal possession of forgery devices. What we've done is just to consolidate all these statutes, and in consolidating the statutes, you can't help but notice the loopholes in existing law, and that's the effect of the article.
I mentioned here to us, just looking at the origin one, with the degrees, actually, they used two degrees in forgery and two degrees in possession of a forgery device, whereas in both of them we just kept one offense.
Yeah, we made it a felony. I think that's an important thing to note because there were some like this code, for example, Oregon had two degrees of forgery, and the commission decided that with forgery it's one degree, it's going to be a felony. What Oregon had was having a misdemeanor forgery offense and a felony forgery offense. Under existing law, forgery is treated very severely, ranging from 2 to 20 years, I think, for most offenses. So we only have one degree there. So I just don't think, sometimes these comments about how we're creating all these degrees, I just don't think they're justified. And when we went over arson, there are 4 degrees of arson in existing law, we had 2. So. Page 78, the next offense is criminal simulation. And again, this is one area where there's only spotty coverage. And what we're trying to prevent here is the fraudulent misrepresentation of objects, antique objects, or archaeological artifacts, or paintings, manuscripts. And existing law only covers the forging or whatever. It's not forging because it's not an instrument. It covers the simulating of gold dust. And there's a specific statute covering possession of adulterated gold dust, a specific statute covering the person who adulterates gold dust, and a specific statute covering the sale of imitation gold nuggets or jade or ivory. But we've done is we have one statue, criminal simulation.
Some of the kids I grew up with made a lot of money doing that about 25 years.
And you know, the gold nugget thing now is a big business because they've learned how to drop the gold in the hot retort and it explodes and makes false nuggets. Mm. And it's a very, if you can't recognize them, it's done frequently.
Well, you know, the other thing is that I would think in this state, with all the native crafts, that I think that's probably a big problem. And in other words, making a totem pole, for example, and saying that this is by a particular native group. And under existing law, that's not, it's true, it's attempted theft by deception, or it might be theft if you actually get the money. But there should be a specific statute just punishing that act, and that's what we've done, and we've covered, made it very broad. I'm sure in New York it was aimed at getting, say, manuscripts or paintings in terms of falsifying. For example, it's not forgery to copy someone's painting because it's not considered a written instrument. Well, in New York they passed a statute, criminal simulation, to cover that kind of conduct. Well, in Alaska it's equally applicable, not to paintings, of course, but to that type of thing, gold nuggets. Or
you know, I think we're losing a lot of history when we pull this, these things relating specifically to gold out of our statutes. There's some things, perhaps, for purely historical value, should be left in.
You know, we have a really historical value. We have Fred Brown's article on the Alaska Criminal Code. You can read it if you don't want to read the history of the Alaska Criminal Code.
But no, there is a certain, you know, you hate to see everything become so modern.
We took the one out about brands and horses and all that good stuff.
You can register brands in Alaska, you know.
There's one in Texas that's still hanging up against the steel shipping
company. We, the branding, by the way, there is that statue on...
Is it a felony?
Oh, son, yeah.
You know what? I know a story about Dankworth.
Hollering brand.
Oh,
and
chickens.
Imitating brand.
About
4,000 horses in Alaska.
If Dankworth and Ducati would still be...
That's a very serious offense down there, stealing with guys. You know, shooting them with a bow and arrow, not a good bow and arrow.
Were you a good shot?
Oh, we killed one in a paper sack. You know, we cooked the chicken and put the feathers in the paper sack and put a rock in it and threw it out in Elm Creek. And the owner came down and caught it. And I happened to glance out and notice the sack, and, you know, the rock had melted out of the sack and the feathers were floating out of the water. The old man Herman didn't notice it.
The thing about the brands, we do have a specific statute on.
I didn't hear that. Just to say, Jenkins, you know that there's a story about that.
On imitating brands, well, under existing law, under the code, that'll be forgery. Because that'll be a brand would be considered a written instrument. Because it would be on something, and it would be the. It would be a purpose of. It would be covered under just under the code. We won't have that statute.
One of the first ones that was my paper is the history of all of us.
Does this count criminal simulation if it says made in Japan right on the bottom of it? Is that, but it's a totem pole, is that criminal simulation?
Well, the statute requires
it
that...
It appears to have an authorship, but it does say made in Japan on the bottom of it.
Well, I suppose if you stuck a hunk of spearmint gum on the bottom and quick sold it to the guy before he pulled the gum off and said made in Japan.
I don't know. I think under... It's not represented in any way to be a native totem pole.
No.
Okay, then I have found difficulty there.
Yeah, but it's written that if he makes or alters or in such a manner that it appears to have authorship, but it does not intend.
Here's a good example. Intent to deprive would be saying this was made by native Alaskans. Right. I was born in Alaska, so. Well, that's obviously.
That's right. Tourists don't
make people say that it was made by.
But there's probably no definition for native.
I know, but that's true. At least I have some. But obviously, you know what I would be trying to do if I did that.
I mean, that's going to get to a almost like consumer type fraud. I think, you know, in terms of if you have it on the bottom there, and you're not holding yourself out to be a native. I can't see how that. Covered.
Okay,
I think that's fire beware.
What if it doesn't have it on the bottom? What if it's just a nice old totem pole? It was actually made in Japan.
We have a statute requiring
the
label.
Nobody told you that it was made by natives. If you're sitting there in the store, and you're in Alaska, you walk in, there's a totem pole, or there's a carving that looks like it's a whale, and it looks like it's out of ivory.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't say made in Japan, it doesn't say made in Norway, or you didn't want to figure out anything too fast. And you're a tourist, oh, you know, and you just assume, because of the context of the store, and what the thing looks like, and where it is, this must be an Alaska native craft thing. And then on your way back, after you left Alaska, you go through Seattle, and find 900 identical ones in the store where the guy clearly tells you that they're all made in Taiwan.
I don't think that would be covered. I think you would have to have some type of representation.
But that's not what it says. It says it appears to have an authorship that it does not in fact possess.
I don't see how a totem pole just standing there appears to have an authorship. If I see a totem pole standing there, the thing that comes to my mind is in the Anchorage Airport, there's that gaudy store there, and I think all the totem poles there are from Japan. I don't think that that's representing that has any authorship there.
Not only that, the typical Anchorage carpetbaggers have a legend under the 49-star flag that has the incorrect date for the time that Alaska became a state.
No kidding.
Yeah.
But what about
that plate? That plate that's right under the flag, you know?
Where?
It says July 4th or something like that. Anyway, they've got it wrong. We became a state at 12:03 Eastern Standard Time, January 3rd, 1959, but the flag did not become official until the 4th of July, 59, and it was only official for 365 days. And some yahoo, you know, typical Anchorage reject, you know, 4.5-year resident who acts, I'm an Alaskan, I've been here for 4 years, comes in with the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce booster rah-rah club, and comes in with this plate making a misstatement about Alaskan history that is so flagrant it's ridiculous. And I look at that thing every time I go through the airport. Now that's fraud.
What about
Sierra Gere? Beautiful, Fred. Beautiful.
What about Benson Boulevard?
Let's have it up. Who's been here in Alaska longer than anybody at this table?
Cherry Garden.
No, right
here. Fred.
I think Fred might.
King.
How old are you, Fred?
Well, yeah, I thought you came here in the 40s. So
how old are you?
I'm 30. I'll be 34 in July.
You can beat me then.
Okay.
What?
Well, how about that?
Were you born here, Fred?
Anchorage.
Providence or the old railroad house?
Old railroad hospital.
The old green building.
Just before it was torn down, I think they tore it down.
It was still there when I came, but.
I hate to be sure.
I know another person that was born in that hospital.
No, did we figure it out as Fred?
Fred's the one
I thought he was.
Runs an office for a millionaire friend of mine in Oakland.
How old are you, Fred? 33?
I'll be 34 in July.
You're 33 then.
Yeah.
What did you say?
Well, you're going to be very close to your from the year, you know.
You're going to be safe where you're not going to be staying that kind of thing.
Okay,
obtaining a signature by deception. Obtaining a signature by deception, that's line 19. And what this statute is getting at is when you obtain someone's signature on a written instrument with intent to defraud that person or to acquire a benefit for yourself. And the best thing that comes to my mind is writing a letter of recommendation that you write yourself, and you give it to your employer, and you say, here, sign this, you know, it's another one of these, with another one of these letters you have to sign. He signs it. Well, it's not a forgery, because the document is signed by him, and it purports to be exactly what it is. He signed it. So you need a separate statute to cover that kind of conduct, and it's covered under obtaining a signature by deception.
This is badly drafted. He causes by deception another to sign. Throw mama from the train and Nish. What is this? Pennsylvania Dutch on page 78, line 22.
Sounds like New York East to me.
Carrying down the stairs in my trousers.
Yeah, right. He causes by deception another to sign.
You go the hell up.
That's what it says.
To sign
a
written
instrument. He causes another to sign by deception. He deceptively causes another to sign.
Sounds good. acting willfully.
It is pretty bad, you know. It really ought to be rewritten.
I'm probably guilty of that because I tell my wife, Simon, aim that check and put it in the bank.
Yeah, but you don't have it. You wouldn't be guilty because you haven't acted with one of the intents in there.
So. Because she thinks it's perfectly legal.
Offering a false instrument for recording is on line 24. And most of it, a lot of times, offering a false instrument for recording is going to be covered under the perjury statutes. That is, if it's a notarized statement, if it's a notarized instrument, it's going to be perjury. If it's an application for a benefit, it's going to be unsworn falsification. What this covers is basically going to the recording office following filing a false statement as the property or a statement reflecting a contractual relationship. And that's the statute.
Now what is this unlawfully using? Slugs.
Okay, I have...
You know what slugs? Those things that grow in California.
Right.
When you don't want somebody's table,
I didn't
remove
it.
Unlawful use.
Yeah. That's why I financed my college, because I'm selling phony IDs and credit card numbers and slugs and...
Well, the slug statute is something...
Why didn't you do that, John? You bought all those tickets or something and you signed on the street line. You bought flowers or something?
No, buttons.
You know, I have a question in this section, in that you're familiar with these...
On the slug section.
On the slug section.
Yeah.
You're familiar with the cards that you use. For example, if I want to get in Ted Stevens' office on Sunday, I have to go and stick my plastic card in the lock.
Yeah. That's called loitering.
And then that there's also that type of a card that you stick in for cash.
Okay.
Is that considered a slug?
Yeah, why
we worked on this right before we came down. Again, this is one of these statutes out there.
Well, no, if you loid, though, what you're doing
what
is
you
unlawfully gaining interest, really.
Well, if the idea of putting the card into the card machine, cash machine, I guess that's what they're called, that's going to be... That is going to be theft if you get the money out. If you if it's a false ID card, it's something you made up, it's going to be forgery because that would be considered a written instrument. So that type of conduct is covered. This statute is aimed at putting like a slug into a vending machine or making
those
slugs.
Why this particularity? Why this one thing? Is there anything else that's like
unlawfully using a slug?
I've tried that. Oh, Terry. The slug statute, I know this was the subject. The thing is, it's kind of like
if you have been so carefully general and not had all these very particularized sections all the way through, and here we get to unlawfully using slugs, I get the idea we ought to have some kind of a general provision relating to this kind of fraud.
But it isn't covered in the sense that, number one, if you make false slugs, the making of false slugs, that would not be...
I make real slugs. I just pass.
Oh, okay. The making of slugs, the making of any slugs, that is not a written instrument. It is not... You can't forge, for example, a slug. It's you're punishing the possession of it.
I'll show you. Here's one of the things we came up with that would be covered by this. You know, they have these deals where you put in your credit card at banks and you get money out, cash. This covers that. If you don't...
It's
a real slug. That's a coin, bill, or token.
Yeah, it was a coin machine,
didn't it? Oh, really? There's coin machine specific. Yeah, I think you only address this coin. Well, it's more
other mechanical.
Coin box, turnstile, vending machine, or other mechanical or electronic device or receptacle designed to receive.
Yeah,
you know, burn the coals and everything against you that aren't
going
to
end up in the
read it.
We're starting at 8 in the morning.
All students without regard to sex.
Can we finish up?
Yeah, we can finish up real quickly here.
Do it.
Let's go.
We're on slugs.
Slugs. Let's slug it out.
Take it away.
Okay, where were we?
copy and a slip. I think it was a question about your statute. We were talking about the change machine, and Terry recalls specifically that this statute covers that. That.
You know, my problem is just the drafting. It looks like it's a particularized statute relating to just one situation that has then been twiddled by contrived definitions. So the definition of coin machine and slug is something nobody in common language would think of a coin machine and a slug, so it covers everything else, and that's not good legislative drafting. You're going to have a generalized...
What is broader than coin machine? What are you going to do with the telephone? It's a coin machine.
You mean you want it to be written, the crime of in defrauding a machine?
Defrauding an
object. Defraud through the use of a device, or some kind of generalized language like that. I'm just saying that this is drafted in the particular and only generalized in the definition section, which seems backwards.
Did they have that in Oregon?
Yeah.
Same way? Because I know, you know the history of the old coin machines back then. It used to be a very strong lobby back in the 49s or 50s, early 50s. Because certain coin machines were a big deal up here, and there was a lot of wars going on, and who was going to control the coin machines. And they came out and got a lot of territorial legislation passed about anybody.
George Thompson.
What was that one of them? Acme coin and Anchorage or whatever they
were? Well, there was Action up there.
Action.
And Action Johnson. Bending.
They actually called it Action?
Yeah, Action Bending.
Oh, boy.
Still there.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
Still there.
What if they're sitting on
the There was a pretty big war over what George got in Nickelodeon. He puts the Nickelodeon in the B joint, you know. Action Bending. That's a big money.
Jesus. Still is.
Anchorage tries so hard to be big time.
What we did, of course, was like everything else, we looked at every other state, and every other, or at least Michigan, New York, and Oregon have. This is how they approach it. That's probably, Barry seems to think that the model penal code didn't approach it any differently.
No, they didn't
cover it.
Yeah, right.
So, if we were to look at something broader, we probably have to contrive it ourselves.
Well, we've
done it
before.
I thought Brown came off close to it just a minute ago. He said just a simple thing, you know, any device.
Defraud the use device. Of a device, and then get into talking about what kind of a device or artifice you are using.
Yeah. I think it's, frankly, every time I mention the title, I get laughs on it. So I just assume change the title.
Mr. Chairman, on page 79 under B in this section, coin machine means.
See, that's what I was complaining about, Keith.
Yeah, I understand.
See, they generalize it there and write in the definition section.
Our slug, one of these places we should cover this plastic card that takes the place of the slug. Or whatever.
Well, you see,
if we're going to get to all this detail, what's the problem with getting to that kind of detail?
I think the way the statute was originally drafted, I think it was originally drafted in New York, and I'm certain that what they were aimed at is getting people that use tokens, false tokens on the subway. It's a major problem in the city. They've arrested, I think, 400 people in the last year. They have a whole separate squad to arrest these people.
Well, you should just dive on the turnstile. I didn't have any tokens, and I was missing the subway.
Well, I think there's a lot of people now using false tokens there. And I think when they use the word token, I think they mean subway token. And I think you can read the statute to cover the credit card type situation, but it's a strange reading. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's really not a credit card.
But
it's
what
a
about
key
attacking this other set of services?
Yeah, it is kind of a key.
What about theft of services?
Well, it is theft of services. There's no question about that. It's theft of property worker services. In other words, if you put it the card in and you get the money, you've committed theft. The problem, of course, is punishing the act, regardless of whether you get the money or not.
I would get my American Express card, you get $500 in about 20 different locations.
Right, that would be theft.
Theft only gets you if you're successful.
Sure, or of course the attempted theft.
This is unlawful using it.
Yeah.
Like the machine's empty.
Well, that would be attempt though. You see, in a way the statute is not necessary because you cover it through either attempt we're using the slug, if it's there's nothing there, if there is something there, you're guilty of theft. The only problem I see though is covering the situation where you make them or you possess the slugs, and that's section 2 here, which is on line 10. The problem of making, possessing, or offering for sale or disposes of a slug with intent to enable a person to use it fraudulently in the coin machine. I don't think, I think the statute is unnecessary in the sense that it gets people and uses it, because if they use it, they're going to be guilty of theft or attempted theft.
Wipe it out.
If it's covered elsewhere, wipe it out. If it's not covered elsewhere, make it general so it doesn't
except
happen to when we try to
do it. 2 isn't covered someplace else.
Okay. Well, okay.
Do you think we'd have to make it clear on this?
Used to be those knockouts out of electrical boxes were just great to put on Coke machines when I was a kid. And then they got to get, technology advanced, and they got to the point that they had their little tumblers so sensitive to the weight of a true coin that you couldn't use the slugs anymore. That's what all the slugs were. They were knockouts from electrical boxes.
Yeah.
I used them all the time when I was a kid.
I should have learned how to drill enough out of it to get the right weight.
Well, we tried some of that. We also sanded them down a bit,
Well, I've been around building this electrical outlet. I can't remember doing that or I would have thought of it.
Well, there's a lot of construction in Fairbanks.
And final.
You're all
okay, let's go on to page 8.
We've all been sharing our crimes.
Miles and Dankworth, and they've got enough for all.
You've got some little crowd here to write a criminal code.
Come on. You must have shot some curse when you were a kid.
Yeah, I sure did. I'm not even going to tell you. I got kicked out of the Girl Scouts.
What in there for it?
Okay, the final statute.
Page 80, and then you can go home.
That's criminal impersonation, and this covers two situations. A person assuming a false identity and doing an act in his assumed character with intent to gain benefit or to defraud, or pretending to be a representative of some person or organization and doing an act in the pretended capacity with intent to gain benefit or defraud.
Oh, that's Stella.
This should be under sex offense.
Now, according to the literal language of this, if a nightclub or a group that wants to do a performance concert in Fairbanks or Anchorage invites Rich Little up, he gets arrested here.
Who's he?
He's one of the finest impersonators in the world. He would be assuming a false identity, doing an act in his assumed character with intent to gain a benefit.
He better not come.
I hope you do. I mean, that's like having common fiddlers as per se vagrants in Nome.
Yeah, I think it's probably all that's necessary. Probably all that's necessary is to say intent to defraud. I'll have to check what the
benefit is.
Yeah, I'll have to look back on that one. I'll have to check it. But under existing law, we're very specific. We only cover certain types of false badges, for example. It lists like being a knight of Pythias or Knight of Columbus in terms of representing yourself to be that. And cover.
Why would anybody want to represent that he was a Knight of Columbus?
Well, I'll check the benefit question here.
There was a case in Anchorage where there was a state in private investigation firm. So police investigators go out there and the state investigators. I guess we tried to make a case against one of those guys. He came back and said, no, I am a state investigator.
Was state investigation.
If I drive up in a white car, get out and walk up and knock on some lady's door, she comes to me and says, I'm an investigator. She looks out and sees the car. It's an assumption that he's with the police department. And he goes home to tell her something out of the try to probably get information or get her to make an admission or something that she didn't see an accident or something. She said, I've already told the police about it. There's a guy who came here and said he was an investigator. So many people don't spend much time thinking about that type of thing. If an investigator comes to you, you assume that it must be one of the police departments. I don't know what he'd be guilty of.
I heard that they read recently that they're getting after the Polk City Director. They called me not long ago, and said, we're putting together a city directory and we need some information. I forgot what they asked, how many children do you have, and where you live, and what's your address, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, hey, we had some kind of bill.
I said, oh, sorry, I'm not going to answer that.
Well, that's that labor department. Labor department did that deal.
That was a bad bill, Fred.
I screamed
that directory, so very valuable.
I understand why the city directory service is used, but I also think we have the right to privacy in this.
Yeah, but the,
I don't want him to know where I am. I don't know what I'm
Well, you don't have to tell anybody.
Well, yeah, but then he goes running around asking 900 neighbors where I am. Sometimes he even gets erroneous information.
Well, the business community, really.
Well, I use the city directory myself. I am in the business community, case, really. Right?
You know, by far and large, find that that's helpful, too.
Like Bill.
Okay, is there any more questions on criminal impersonation?
It is good to do.
Well, it would also include a female impersonator, a male impersonator.
Yeah, well, I guess you read literally, and I guess that's the way we should read them. It would cover that. That's correct.
No, but just your plain transvestite that runs around. No,
I would cover that.
Well,
it's to defraud, to mislead.
Well, I don't think it's...
Well, lots of them, surprisingly enough, I know a number of them in Anchorage, because we've caught a bunch of them, and they're not, they're hard.